I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation recorded live at the 2021 Festival.
Good morning and welcome to Sydney's Writers Festival 2021. My name's Nicole Aberdy and I'm delighted today to be speaking with two of Australia's favourite writers, Nikki Gemmill and Sophie Laguna, about their latest novels. And that is Nikki's The Ripping Tree and Sophie's Infinite Splendours. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. Let me start by introducing Nikki Gemmill. Nikki is the best-selling writer of 13 works of fiction, including Shiver, Cleave, and The Bride-Stripped Bear. She has also written four non-fiction books, her most recent being After, a powerful memoir about her mother's death by suicide. Her books have been translated into 22 languages, and in France she's been called the female Jack Kerouac. She writes a weekly column for the Weekend Australian magazine, and one reviewer has said about her latest book, the one we're talking about today, if ever a book deserved to become a classic, The Ripping Tree does. Please welcome Nikki. Now I'd like to introduce Sophie Laguna. Sophie started writing books for children, which have been widely published overseas. And then in 2008, she published her first adult novel, One Foot Wrong. Her second adult novel, The Eye of the Sheep, won the 2015 Miles Franklin Literary Award. Her third, The Choke, won the 2018 Indie Book Award for Fiction. Both books were shortlisted for various other awards, including the prestigious International Dublin Impact Award. One reviewer has said about Infinite Splendours that it is written with compassion and tenderness and Laguna's characteristic aptitude for inhabiting the inner spaces of a vulnerable pre-adolescent. The way I'm going to approach this session today with these two beautiful writers so as to give them both the proper opportunity to talk about each of their beautiful books is I'll spend an equal amount of time. First, I'll speak to Nikki for about 20 minutes about her book, then to Sophie for about 20 minutes about her book, and then we'll have about 10 minutes where there's a conversation between the three of us. So I'm going to start with Nikki. I'm going to ask her about The Ripping Tree. Nikki, start by telling us what's it all about.
Okay. And thank you so much for that lovely introduction, Nicole. It is so wonderful to be here, back in person, all of us. What a great feeling and a great Writers' Festival this is. The Ripping Tree. It's taken me 10 years to write this one. It's very different to what I've ever written before. My heart is in my mouth with it. It's historical fiction. It's a psychological thriller. I was thinking as I was writing it of various things. I'm going to take my glasses off. I feel like there's a distance between us. I'm blind now, but I know I can feel your warmth. I was thinking of various things as I was writing it, as disparate as The Turn of the Screw, the film The Wicker Man, the film Get Out, Rebecca. I was thinking of a protagonist like Sibylla in My Brilliant Career or Juju in Seven Little Australians, who I'm still traumatised about. I wanted a passionate, headstrong, feisty, stubborn young woman who finds herself, a little like Viola in Twelfth Night, a stranger in a strange land, washed up on an island, and she has a chance to reinvent herself. This is a woman who, she's shipwrecked off the coast of Australia. It could be anywhere. I did research on the Dumbuy wreck just off South Head here in Sydney to get myself into the frame of it, but it could be anywhere. She's shipwrecked. She's rescued by an Aboriginal man, taken to an illustrious house. I did my research in northwestern Tasmania for that one, a beautiful colonial mansion. What she finds, a little bit like the film Get Out, if anyone has seen it, she thinks she's made it when she arrives, but she gradually realises over the course of 7 days that nothing is as it seems. And in the end, it's the shout line, which I loved making up for my book, get out, before they save you. So this illustrious family, in the end, ends up endangering her life and she has to escape. I wanted something with a driving narrative, but I wanted also to pick at the scab of the darkness of Australian colonialism, and or perhaps it's a gaping wound that we're unable to reconcile ourselves with. But I wanted to confront that head on in a way in the glossy package of a thriller and a young, feisty female protagonist who wants to be something fiercely that the world around her says she cannot be. So I don't know if that's too long and rambling.
No, that's a terrific description. Just a few things were clarified. Set in the early 1800s, yes. The early days of the colony, the young woman who you talk about, who's the heroine of the book, we're going to call her Poss because that's what she ends up being called in the book. Her real name is Thomasina. And she's coming over, she's only 16, mm-hmm. She's coming over from England. For what purpose? How does she find herself on that ship on the way to Australia?
Her family's trying to marry her off to a vicar. Mm. And it's the last thing she wants. The vicar's twice her age, and she wants to escape that whole world and what her family has decided for her. In fact, it's her older brother who she doesn't get on with. And so this is why in the shipwreck, when all records are lost and everything's lost, she has the chance to reinvent herself in a new land. So she wants to grab that and go for it.
So let's talk a little bit about this family, the Craw family. She lands on their doorstep at Willowbrae, the name of their fine mm-hmm. colonial home. And she makes a particular friend with the little boy, Mouse.
Yes.
His name is, he's about 7.
Yep.
She is, for want of a better word, a real tomboy, as you've described her. She's feisty, she's strong, she's, her mother died when she was young. She's been raised by her father, who's encouraged her to be free and to do what she wants to do. This is very challenging for the Craw family mm-hmm. from day one. Mm-hmm. What does she do? How does she behave? And why is it so confronting for that family?
She has a voice, which I think is often still problematic for women. You know, outspoken women, I find it every week with my column, I have a voice. And there are people who don't like me talking out, asking questions, raising difficult truths, asking, but that feels unfair. Why is it like that? Why is it so unfair? I feel like my passion is fairness. It's always been my passion throughout my life. And this book, in a way, embodies that. This is a young woman who's been raised in isolation and then comes into this world, a very wealthy, very comfortable world, and she just looks all around her and says, but this is so unfair. What's going on? And she's using her teenage sensibility. So she's constantly asking questions. She's constantly not being quiet. She wants to wear the trousers, literally.
Tell us about the clothing. So she's grown up being allowed to wear boys' clothes.
Yeah, yeah,
and so
yeah,
she persists with that here. And that's something that really, I'm going to say, sticks in the craw of the craw, but really drives them mad.
Yes, yes.
Tell
yes.
us about that. How does she like to get dressed, and why does
well,
she like to wear the boys'
it's
clothes?
As simple as, you know, she's actually worn trousers before and she feels the freedom of that, the freedom of being able to put your hands in pockets. I love pockets. You know, I find it, if I've got a pocket in an outfit, I'm free and I'm comfortable and I'm centred and I feel calm and solid. And she's like that too. When she wears bloke's boots, she just feels different and strong. But this is a family of boys. There are three sons, and the mother, Mrs. Craw, she lost a daughter early on in this savage land that this woman came from. She's from Scotland, actually, in this strange, spiky, savage land called Australia. So the daughter was lost in an accident. And when Poss arrives, the mum thinks, great, I've got a daughter. At last, I've got someone who I can mould, my little doll. This is wonderful. So she tries to, you know, straighten everything and constrain everything with corsets and skirts. And I did so much research about clothing and all the rest of it. So there are so many different things woven into there.
There's a real sense of an issue of power and control, isn't there, that everybody, every member of that family, with the exception of Mouse, is trying to control her. So you've talked about Mrs. Craw with the clothing. So that's literally trying to control her. What about Mr. Craw? How does he deal with her, and how does he try to control or subdue her?
Well, I was really interested in the very modern idea of ghosting. Mm. And a little bit with James, what he did in Turn of the Screw, and his protagonist, you know, she thinks, am I mad? Am I seeing things? What is going on? So the Craw family is trying to ghost this protagonist and basically say, I don't want to give away spoilers, but Poss unearths something on the property that is absolutely shocking, and the income streams, how this family makes their money. She's asking questions about it. Her mind's going a million miles an hour. The family's saying, you're not seeing anything. There's not a problem. This is how we do things here. This is what happens in this place. Be quiet. She feels ghosted. Mm. She starts to think, am I mad? And then another strand of research that I did was hysteria. Mm. In terms of, you know, the threat over women that, you know, they will be sent off to an asylum for asking too many questions, for being too stubborn, for being too outspoken, all these different reasons that women were sent away. She's got that fear hanging over her too.
Nikki, one very significant concern of the Ripping Tree is the relationship between the European settlers, represented here by the Craws, and the Indigenous people. Tell us about the Craw's attitude towards the Indigenous people.
I think you'd have to read the book.
Okay, all right. Let's suffice to say that it's not what you'd hope for.
No. This family has acquired a lot of land in ways that can only be imagined. I guess with all my books from, you know, whether it's Bride Strip Bear or After about suicide and euthanasia, I don't want to shy away from difficult truths. I like provocative writing. I like writing that disturbs. I like to get the reader to think. Yes, I want to move them most of all, and I want to transport them with a rip-roaring, galloping story. But if they come away thinking, gosh, wow, really? And I had a wonderful Indigenous academic read the whole manuscript from John Maynard from an Indigenous Studies Centre at Newcastle University. Mm-hmm. And he was wonderful. I loved the to and fro. He suggested things that I perhaps should change, some things I completely took out. The shocking heart of the book, the real jolt of the book, he absolutely wanted in there. And I think that to me was a signal that we don't talk about these things enough. We should talk about them. I think of my dad as my reader. It's dedicated to him. And he's never read any of my books. He picked up the first page of Shiver, my first novel, and there was a word in it he didn't approve of. Put it down. Never read a single one since. And he died in December last year, just before this book came out. And I actually thought, you know what, Dad? This one you would have read. And you would have looked at me and said, oh, but that kind of stuff didn't happen. And I would have said, yeah, Dad, go back. Go back to history. Go back to the oral records and just read. And then you'll understand the grief, perhaps, and the trauma and all the rest of it. So that...
You made a deliberate choice. There are Indigenous characters in the book, but we don't hear very much from them. And I've heard you talk about this before.
Yeah.
You made a deliberate choice that you would not write in the voice of an Indigenous character.
That's
Tell us about that.
Well, I just, you know, there's a lot of talk about this kind of thing now, and I didn't think it was my right to do that. I didn't think I have enough knowledge to do that. I wouldn't dare to write from the perspective of an Indigenous character. My second novel, Cleave, was set in the Central Australian desert within an Indigenous community. I wrote that 25, 30 years ago. I'd lived in Alice Springs for several years. But even back then, I felt I have no right to step into the shoes of an Indigenous person. I absolutely admire and respect these people, but I don't understand and I don't have the knowledge, so why should I presume to think that I could be writing in their voice when they should be writing in their voice and they can be writing in their voices so powerfully? So that was a deliberate choice. Mm. And it, yeah.
Nikki, you've said, not in relation to this book, but to another book, you said in answer to a question, I write to answer questions. There is something unknown or bewildering, and I write to either answer the question of why or what's gone on here. What was the question you were answering with the ripping tree?
There were so many questions I was answering with the ripping tree. I guess I wanted to write what felt like a very truthful, honest account about a young thinking woman's perception of the world around her in colonial Australia. And I just think in terms of everything that's gone on throughout my adult life with, the Indigenous situation, the heart-rending situation that I feel like I've been invested in this for years and years and years. I wrote about it in my second novel. Here I am with, I can't even remember what novel you said this was.
13.
My sixth? 13?
Not your sixth.
My sixth.
13.
I'm cutting out a lot there. This is now my 13th and I've revisited it again. It grieves me deeply. And we need to know these truths. And you know, I wrote this book thinking, I don't know if it's worked. I just don't know what I've done here. But amazingly, the people who read it seem to be picking up and responding to what I was trying to do. And that's like, oh my God, thank you.
in some ways extraordinary way, it is very much of this moment, the portrayal of a feisty young headstrong woman who people are trying to silence, in particular men are trying to silence. I want to just ask finally, and then we'll get on to Sophie, about something you wrote recently in relation to the rape allegations by Brittany Higgins and against Christian Porter.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote an article about that, and you, as you were writing, as a constant refrain, you used the words, I am rage.
Yes.
And you said this, anger changes the world for the better. This is a watershed moment. The rage is real and still seething. It is seamed like an underground river right through so many women. Now, you wrote The Ripping Tree before those events happened. However,
yes,
that comment seems very pertinent.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, to what extent is The Ripping Tree an expression by you of rage at attempts to control and silence strong women through the ages?
Absolutely. It's about a woman who has a voice, and people want her voice silenced. Just last week, you know, in terms of that terrible, terrible domestic violence murder in Brisbane with the woman who was set alight, and then followed, I think, a day later by the awful situation at the dam in South Australia, the beautiful young baby who was killed by her father. I got a forward email from a man the day that was all happening. And he just said to me, because I have an email address on the bottom of my column in the Weekend Australian, he just said, shut the fuck up. That's what I get every week. And when I was younger, that would make me think, I can't do this anymore. I can't, you know, that just the grime and the filth and the wave of wanting me to stop would get to me. But now that I'm this age, it's like, I am so going to write about that now.
Good
so
for
that's
you.
Why I wrote this, and that's why I'm going to write about that. And that's the rage.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thank you.
Sophie, let's move now to talk about your beautiful book, Infinite Splendours. And I've just realised I forgot to ask you all to give Sophie a round of applause for her beautiful work. So please do that now.
No, I was so enjoying listening to Nikki. Just go on. Yeah, I was enjoying it.
So let's talk about Infinite Splendours, your beautiful work, Sophie. What's it about and where is it set?
So Infinite Splendours tells the story of Lawrence Lohmann, who, when the story begins, is 10 years old. Do you know that it sounds silly, but I'm immersed in other characters. And even though I've known that I'm coming along and I've spoken at length about Infinite Splendors, suddenly I'm thinking, who is it? And what is it? But I was with it for a number of years. And Lawrence Lohman, When the Story Begins, is 1953. And Lawrence he's 10, and he lives with his mother, Louise, and his younger brother, Paul, in a small house at the base of the Southern Grampian Mountains. Mm. And he goes to the local school, Huelon Consolidated, and he's a bright, open and curious boy. And the future looks bright because he discovers painting. And then a family member unexpectedly comes to the house to stay, and everything is forever changed. And then the rest of the novel will chart the course of his growth following the visit events from the family member.
So, Sophie, when it starts, when we're introduced to the Lohman family, yep, we learn that their father died during the war. I think that Lawrence himself was only two when mm-hmm. his father died. Mm-hmm. So this is a little tight-knit family made up of the three of them. Lawrence mm-hmm. is 10, his brother is 8, their mother Louise is in her 30s, and mm-hmm. they're a pretty close little trio. And although they don't have a father, the boys seem to have a pretty happy childhood. Mm. I just want to ask you a little bit more, because I'd like to focus on what Lawrence was like. As you've said, and we're not going to say anything more, mm-hmm. something terrible happens to Lawrence. Mm. I just want to go back in time to before that happens. What's he like as a student? What are his interests? What sort of a little boy is he?
He feels a sense of responsibility for his mother, so he caretakes to a degree. He loves his brother, Paul. He's responsive to nature around him. He loves the mountain that looms over the house, Wallace, and he looks to Wallace each and every night as he falls asleep. So Wallace is a kind of a guardian. Wallace is someone to return home from school to, so it's not just mother waiting at the gate, it's the mountain. So I suppose then you could say that he's sensitive.
And he's very bright academically,
isn't he? He's academically bright. He's open. He absorbs everything that his teachers have to give him about science, about books. His teachers reading him have gone completely blank.
Robinson Crusoe.
And he loves to sit and listen with his classmates, but he's also, he knows how to have fun, and he's mischievous at times.
And his favourite lessons are the art lessons. He has a teacher who he really loves who encourages him.
Mrs. St. Clair.
In his art. Then, as we said, something terrible happens to him. Mm-hmm. How does Lawrence change? What is he like after this event? And how does he change from the happy-go-lucky, bright, open little boy that he was?
Well, a process begins, doesn't it? You know, a family member comes from the outside world and a process begins. I think that's unavoidable to say, you know, I don't think that's giving away too much. It just has to be said. It's pretty much there hinted at on the back of the book. A family member comes to stay and...
Things
change, but the family member coming to stay, and he stays for about, I think, 3 weeks, is a very... is a deeply expansive experience also. So it's too simple to say that grooming that takes place is just one thing, because it is also life-changing in a positive way for Lawrence.
He's like a father figure, isn't he?
He's a father figure, and he's an outside voice that tells Lawrence there is a world of art. There are other painters. There are galleries. There are museums that exhibit works of art. He's worldly. And he appreciates the mountain. He empathises with Lawrence, and he knows the words to say, and he charms Lawrence. He uses his adult powers of seduction to charm Lawrence. And Lawrence, he knows as soon as he meets Lawrence that this isn't going to be difficult, I suppose.
And then after the terrible events happen, one of the most obvious things about Lawrence is that he almost loses the power of speech.
Yes.
He starts to stammer, and he has... physical as well as mental anguish, really, doesn't
he? Yeah, that's the right word, anguish. Yeah, he does. And he carries a great deal of shame. He can't speak about it, and he stops being able to use words. And I think that is both a defence, a protective sort of a defence, and an expression of the trauma that he suffered.
And the way you portray this is just so heartbreaking, but so very real. We see a little boy who was previously academically the top of his class, so the other kids were sick of him always answering the questions.
Yeah, that's right.
To not being able to answer a question, not being able to speak, and the other kids teasing him.
He's disassociated in class, so he can still see the desks and the classroom and the teachers, but he's absent.
Sophie, then something happens. So that's what we see when he's 10 through his teenage years. Mm-hmm. And then his mum dies when he's in his early 20s, and he's plunged into a deep despair. That's the next really major, major event in his life. Mm. But then something saves him just when he's at his lowest ebb, when he's at the point of losing all hope. He looks out the window, and what does he see?
Well, that's right. The warbler, the crested warbler, the pigeon, draws his attention from the apple tree to the mountain.
And the mountain.
Yes, Lawrence, that's Wallace. Really considers the mountain. And even though, you know, you describe it as, well, it is a loss. His mother dies. And he wonders is it a critical moment? Is there any point? Has he seen everything there is to see? Everybody's gone. The pigeon draws his eye to the mountain, and it's as if the mountain communicates with Lawrence and says, it's up to you. The mountain wants to be shown something about the mountain's invisible self that only Lawrence can see. It's up to you, Lawrence. And Lawrence, I guess, changes his mind and begins to paint again.
And what
so
does he paint?
I think it's not only, though, his mother's passing is also a part of that decision. You know, it wasn't just that he was going to survive. It was also something about his mother's, she's left, has given him also the space to be renewed, I think. Mm. And so he, that very day, begins to paint with enormous energy and commitment, and finds himself very quickly completely immersed in the work of the painting and in the natural environment that he is communicating in his painting. And so from that, from really those first hours of realising that, he relaxes.
Mm.
He relaxes for the first time since his uncle came, and he forgets himself. And for the first time, there are fewer questions tormenting him. His thoughts slow down. I suppose he's more present. Finally, he's present, and he's got the space because his mother is not there.
Mm.
That is one of the reasons.
Mm.
It's not an accident, that timing. So that is his experience. It's bliss, and absolute bliss. I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm getting carried away remembering it, you know, because he comes home from painting in the field and he lights the fire, and then for the first time he delights in flame. He delights in preparing his own meal. He delights in nourishment. His stomach settles. I suppose what I'm saying, which I'm only realising right in this moment now, because when you're doing it, I'm not, you know, not aware in such a sort of conscious way, but that is what art is doing. That is what creativity is doing for him. It's giving him life, isn't it?
And Sophie, he paints landscapes, doesn't he? That's his particular focus. He paints Wallace, which he loves.
He does.
And Wallace, I should say, is like a character in this book. Lawrence refers to him as he, and he's a very important part of his life. How does nature become a source of refuge and joy to him?
Well, he does paint Wallace repeatedly, and he paints the views from Wallace, but then also on the way home, he will pick up leaves or pull a blossom from a tree or pick up stones or feathers, and he will look at the way fruit is falling from the bowl or the orange peel or the window frame or the dried apple core, and then he will draw. So nature, I suppose he is communicating with nature, is he? Or is he trying to show something about nature through the filter of his own experience? That's how he describes it. It brings him peace. He's not conscious of any of this particularly. Mm. I suppose if you are painting nature, you're looking at it, aren't you? You're looking at it. You're not inside your own skin in the same way, and that's liberating.
Sophie, something else that brings him comfort and strength is a book called Letters from the Masters.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about that book and why it's so important to Lawrence, why that too becomes a source of comfort for
him? Well, yeah, and interestingly, it was his uncle that gave him that book. And that was an incredible sort of a gift to give him. And he describes it as being ahead of where he knows he's not quite mature enough. And he knows, he questions whether it's right. And would he really, would he show his mother some of those naked bodies in some of those paintings?
So it's filled with paintings as well as letters?
Yes. So it feels, he feels a little, he feels there's a shame around it. He feels that it's illicit, but wildly exciting and mature, and it's leading him forward. And it's uncle that's given it to him. So it's a language that can't be shared with anyone else in the house between uncle and him, which is, again, very divisive, you know, and becomes a kind of a pact unspoken between them, which is really dangerous and really seductive at the same time. So the letters are all real letters written by real painters of the 1800s to their mentors, their patrons, their wives.
How did you find those?
I have a couple of those books.
Have books like this that have letters.
And I remember, I actually found it, it all sounds very exciting, but I found it in a secondhand bookshop in New York. And wow. It probably held the same magic for me as it did for Lawrence. How exciting. Real letters with the paintings beside them. Personal letters about artists who are no longer with us, telling their deepest fears and their struggles and their secrets and everything that you can relate to, ordinary things, their feelings of failure. These are some of the most recognised paintings in the world, how human they were. And Lawrence was a bright man, and he does love words, and he had the world waiting for him. He had the world of words waiting for him, and it was lost. And all he's given is this one book. But they're really, a lot of the letters are really sophisticated and describe very sophisticated worlds. And of course, he responds passionately, and he loves them.
They bring comfort to him.
They bring comfort, and he feels part of a community. There are other writers, painters.
He says something lovely at one stage that Lawrence feels very alone a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But he says about this book, every letter in the book was written to me. I was not alone.
Mm.
So it's that sense of comfort, isn't it, and connection.
Yeah, and many years after his uncle left, there it was on the shelf. He knew exactly where it was for about 13 years. He knew where it was on the shelf. And then, after his mother dies, then he takes the book off the shelf. And so, the world is further open to him. He probably knows every letter off by heart by the time we meet him again in his 50s.
So when we do meet him again in that final part, he's now got an absolute passion for painting. His house is filled with the paintings that he's done.
Yeah.
But he's also developed a passion for the opera, in particular Madame Butterfly.
Yeah.
And there's a lovely, there's so much beautiful writing in this book. We'll come to that in a moment. There's such beautiful writing in both of your books. But he says something really beautiful. He says, I too had places within me. Painting took me to those places, and Butterfly, and beer. Walking up the mountain. Sophie, could you talk to us about the role of art, the paintings, the letters by the masters, Madame Butterfly, as a source of comfort and redemption for Lawrence, who has had such a traumatic event in his childhood?
Well, the music, I suppose, in the same way as I've described that act of painting, carries him to higher places and expresses his feelings, which are complex and mature, some of those feelings. The despair, Madame Butterfly sings of despair and betrayal. He relates to that, I suppose. Mm-hmm. It's very beautiful. He responds to beauty. Mm. In the same way he does when he looks at those paintings in the book. They're a whole... They speak to worlds that he carries within him.
Mm. There's something at one point you say, or he thinks about Madame Butterfly, that there is beauty in sadness.
Mm.
And I was wondering about this as well. Lawrence ends up producing these beautiful paintings.
Mm.
Someone who's had... something really terrible happened to them, has clearly been very traumatised by it. But he finds an outlet through his art, through his paintings. And I wondered in this book if one of the things you were looking at was the extent to which all great art is the product of sadness or suffering.
I read somewhere the other day, I think it was Baudelaire wrote that there is no beautiful art without a note of melancholy, or something better than that. I wonder if it's true. I wonder if there is nothing beautiful that can be created that does not hold a note of melancholy. He's interested in the fact that it's passing, so it has to hold, doesn't it? It's fleeting. Mm. It's fleeting. So any beautiful moment is only transitory. But then sadness, really, that's our human imposition on it, isn't it? You know, there are other greater, more realised minds than mine, I'm sure, who don't need to call it sadness or melancholy. It's passing. It's passing. So what? But Lawrence appreciates its transitory nature, and maybe that's what makes it so special. Sorry, I've forgotten your question now.
No,
Nicole.
I think you've
answered carried
it.
Away.
Sadness.
No, so he considers that, yes, that the music of Madame Butterfly and that paintings hold that note of sadness, and he's okay with that in the end. You know, when I've spoken about the book over the past 6 months, there is some focus on all that, you know, that isn't realised for Lawrence and the price that he pays and all that he doesn't get to have. But I wonder if that is made up for. I mean, maybe many readers wouldn't think it's made up for. But I think he lives a relatively long life. You know, in world terms, it's long. Mm. And he comes to know bliss. Mm. He knows bliss. He knows transcendent feeling. He asks the biggest of questions. Mm. Where did we come from and where are we going? And he sort of swims around in those, and he does his best to express his response to those, and he's in love with nature. And he knows, he doesn't get to know, I suppose, in some ways, intimacy with other human beings. And that's a significant thing not to have. And many, many people don't get to have that for one reason or another. That's a struggle for many. Intimacy with other human beings is really difficult. And he comes to know it in other ways that some people never find. So I wonder. And he leaves behind, is the word legacy? In my imagining,
yes.
He leaves behind an enormous legacy. So he's lived a really generous life, regardless of the selfish act that took so much from him. He didn't. So it's really hopeful if I stop and think now.
So I'm going to get you to stop there just so that we have time to talk. That's absolutely beautiful what you've said, and it's a very beautiful book. I want to talk to both of you now and address some questions to both of you. One of the things that I really noticed in both of your books is that the sound of the writing and the rhythm of the language is very important to both of you. Nikki, much of the writing in The Ripping Tree is, I think, verging on the poetic, and I know that you are a poetic person. If you follow Nikki on Instagram, she often writes in poetry. But I'm just going to give you one example of one sentence.
From my Instagram?
No, from your book.
God.
No, from your book. I can barely say it because I'll trip over it, but it's salty, sailory cussing that's now tipping him into thrillingly illicit territory. Now, don't tell me that's not somebody who chooses their language carefully. How important is it to you to choose the right words, and how hard do you work to find the right words?
Look, poetry is my tuning fork. I can't read other novels when I'm writing my own novel, but I can read Anne Carson or Les Murray or, you know, so many. The stack that's high of poetry on my bedside table, and I just have to open up to a page or whatever, and it just puts me in the zone. But for me, it's not just about the right word and the poetry. It's the musicality of the sentences. I find rhythm so important as a writer. It's musical. It's you know, you can't have the dull repetition of a thudding, like several sentences that are broken up by one comma. Everything is so particular for me, and it drives me bananas, I must admit, at The Australian, because I have lovely, lovely sub-editors who are very used to editing reporters. And so I've got my really strong musical rhythm through my 670 words, but they don't get it. They change it. Yeah, they change. And it's like, I feel like so ridiculously fussy saying, no, that's meant to be a comma there, because if you're listening to it in your head, or if you're saying it aloud even more, you will understand the musicality of the sentence. Or maybe I am the only one who understands that as the reader. But for me, that's very important too.
Sophie,
I do a lot of drafts.
Sophie, I read that you read your work out loud, and you've spoken about what you call the work of getting all the words right and in the right place. It's as if the book were a song. Could you tell us about how you make sure you get the words in the right place and you choose the right words?
Well, reading aloud is helpful. Do you read aloud, Nikki, your books?
No, because all my kids would laugh at me.
Okay.
So, no, but I should.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good way to hear it, hear the music of it. It's a fairly intuitive process. So I just has to feel, each word has to feel like it's in the right place. And often I think less is more. I'm learning, I think, the more I go along. Fussier and fussier, I suppose, about adjectives and everything else. Yeah.
Something else I thought that you two had in common with these latest books was that for each of you, and correct me if I've got this wrong, but it seemed to me, for each of you, these books are a bit of a departure from your previous work. Nikki, I'll just ask you first. You've said about this one, I tried to do something serious and deeply political with this one under the glossy cover of a historical thriller. How did that feel, and how did you enjoy writing in a more overtly political way about issues around Indigenous people and about women?
Well, I feel like I've often written in a political way, so that's not different. In terms of Cleave, that was political, Indigenous communities. Bridestrip Bear was political, female sexuality.
Yes.
So it's not so much that, it's more the genre that I was writing in. Male writers write different things, you know, and they don't seem to get the questions of why are you writing differently? Why can't I? Mm. Why can't I try something new? I'm always kind of risking, maybe I fail, you know, I don't know, but I want to give it a go. It was exhilarating.
I was just going to ask, did you enjoy this process?
I mean, it took me 10 years. Life kept on getting in the way. I have a son who's 9, so basically he was conceived around the same time as this book was. My newspaper column is 10 years old, so that takes a huge weekly chunk of my mental space. I've never spent 10 years on a book before, but I loved writing in this way. I fell in love with my character. I want to continue her story if I possibly... Oh, that's a spoiler. Oh, God. I love trying something different. I always have.
Sophie, with this one, you've written before your other books from the perspective of a child exposed to trauma. But this is really the first time, I think, that you've taken that into adulthood and you've looked at the life of an adult and how the life of an adult can be impacted by childhood trauma. How did you enjoy that process of following into the, from the mind of a child into the mind of an adult?
Well, I began with him as an adult, so that's what drew me to the character in the first place. I mean, I met him as an older man, and I loved it. Yeah, I was very bonded with him for the 2 or 3 years that I wrote the story, and yeah, I felt it was a strange sort of. It sounds crazy, I suppose. I just felt his presence all the time over my shoulder, and it was deeply reassuring. As who could explain that? But that's how it was, and. I think these characters actually can carry things for us. They can carry things for us and into the world. And, yeah, he can make the experience of being human, perhaps he lightens the load or something. No, great. It was thrilling. And
you loved your character too, the way yeah. Nikki said she loved hers.
Yeah, it was great fun. I mean, writerly fun, if you know what I mean. I mean, you know, concentrating sort of fun, responsible fun.
But Sophie, do you find that your character slips away from you, that they become something else, you can't kind of control it? I feel like with me, I always start out with this grand plan of who they're going to be and what they're going to do. And then as I write, you can't kind of grasp onto that anymore.
That's true. You sort of have to, I suppose it's the dance between the two, isn't it? The control and finding out what might be under there that you haven't yet come upon. But I could. He had a pretty strong essence, and he remained pretty consistent.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that, you know, because he was older and he did appreciate words, that I could be really playful with words, perhaps in a way that a younger well, all characters use words differently, so they all have their limitations, no matter their age, and they all have their freedoms. And he had a particular set which I enjoyed. Yeah, and using those letters was fun.
We're going to have to stop there, sadly. I wish that we could keep going. Thank you so much, all of you, for coming.
Thank you.
Huge thank you to Sophie and Nikki.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to and rate our channel wherever you listen to your podcasts.